Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 731.GN2922, certificate number 35320, Lodge Night.
Put it there, brother. The secret water buffalo handshake. The secret password, brother. That kind of gives you a certain feeling, doesn't it, Barney?
Sure does, Fred.
You were at our little end-of-summer barbecue a couple weeks ago.
It sure was. One of the best parties I've ever been to. Scintillating conversation. Extremely crazy.
I like your new take.
Crazy, crazy party. Just wild.
People dancing on tables.
Yeah, off the hook.
Did one of those pyramids of champagne glasses where it's like one glass at the top, but then it fills like 100 glasses at the bottom.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Always got to have one of those.
Except it was beef gravy you were pouring
it's
into it.
So weird.
Yeah.
We just like the way it drips.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Everybody got a heaping champagne goblet of beef gravy.
A lot of really famous people there, too. Like, nutty, nutty guest list.
Like you.
Like I was there. And some other people, too.
But you met our neighbors.
I did.
The weird thing about
I've met them before.
You know some of our neighbors. The weird thing about our cul-de-sac somehow is that everyone's named Julie. All the wives are named Julie, which is very useful.
Yeah, sure.
I mean,
Julie.
It's a little bit Stepford, Don't Worry, Darling kind of a vibe.
Yeah.
But they're not, they don't all look the same. They don't all look like Betty Draper. They're not coming out of a factory somewhere.
I was on a parent-teacher Zoom call yesterday, and one of the parents chimed in, and she said, "Hi, I'm Katie." And I said, "Of course you are." She was the most Katie I'd ever seen. If you had asked me what her name was before she started talking, I would have said Katie.
What conveys, is like Katie Couric a perfect Katie?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, a Katie kind of has a
perky.
Like, yeah, perky, a little bit of a round face. She's got Katie hair. She's small. Katies are small, typically.
Like Katie Dids.
Like Katie Dids, yeah. And just, yeah, really like, I don't know, excitable, cute moms. Katie's.
You have to give an example of doing this with a male name as well, or it's problematic.
Oh, I see. Let's see. Paul.
What are Pauls like?
Oh, they're dull.
Yeah, I was about to say. Yeah. Like, Paul seemed kind of like a little bit drawn, kind of maybe an Eeyore type.
Yeah, they have bowl haircuts, a lot of them.
All of them have.
Yeah.
I mean, we do this
gangly.
We actually do this with male names all the time. Like, yeah. Maybe more so, I guess Karen is a type, but Chad is the ultimate example of the name that became a type.
Right. I know a Chad, and he is very handsome.
He probably, does he hate it, or does he embrace the Chad thing?
Oh, no, he's maybe not even aware of it.
See? Yeah. He is a Chad.
I think he listens to the show. I think Chad is probably listening right now and going, "I'm handsome?" No, he knows he's handsome.
Chad, you know you're a good-looking guy.
But he's not a Chad. He's like a different kind of Chad. He's like an indie rock
indie
Chad.
Indie Chad. Julies are all very different on our street, but our next door neighbor, Julie, is,
I mean, they're not all that different. They all live on the same cul-de-sac in, in Greenwood.
Yeah, but if you bought 20 years ago, like they're not,
I see.
Or more, you know, like, they don't all have to be the same kind of minted Seattle, tech era Seattle.
Some of
couples.
Them are $350,000 mortgage
exactly.
Julies, and some of them are $1,000,000.
You can literally
Julies.
Add a zero yeah. to some of the purchase prices on that street. But no, it's just kind of a regular middle-class cul-de-sac as far as that exists in North Seattle, which is to say not much.
But they're lovely. Their kids were kind of the age of our kids and would have like Nerf wars in the street when they were little.
Toxic masculinity, in other words.
No, I was actually kind of led by the girls, but that's, I guess that's the problem. See, internalized misogyny, making right. girls play with Nerf guns.
Yeah. When they should be playing with dolls. Is that what you're saying?
No. God, Ken.
Get
Legos.
Your story straight.
Legos, I think, or a crystal radio kit. I don't know. Their kids were into music as our kids were, but then their kids got into jazz.
Oh dear.
When our kids got into, you know, marching band and,
jazz.
And so their parents are super jazz.
I see.
So we have a jazz family next door.
Do they smoke jazz cigarettes?
We don't smell jazz, but we hear an awful lot of jazz.
Do they ever say that they dig something? Do they ever call you Hepcat? Man? Hey, man.
I feel like man, yes. Maybe even dig, yes. But you kind of have, there's a kind of a thing where they code shift. Like jazz people today,
sure.
They understand, unless they're, if they're talking about jazz, they'll suddenly tell you that something swings or that they dig it.
For sure.
Whereas if they were telling you to watch Beef on Netflix, they're not going to say, this show really scat. Swings. I really dig it.
Shoobity doobity doo wah.
So I think you get them talking about jazz and they're very active. You know, they'll go to clubs, you know, they'll travel to the East Coast just to see a combo they like.
Weird.
Do they have freaks?
Do they have a vinyl collection?
Oh,
for sure.
Of all the things and we would hear their kids practice and their kids would just play every instrument. So like somebody's soloing on the Barry sax and then somebody else is soloing on the stand up bass. And really, we kind of liked it. Of all the kind of ways that your neighbor relationship could go wrong,
yeah,
the fact that they're really listening to a lot of kind of cool and bebop era jazz is really so low on the list.
Yeah, no, that's,
it's almost an advertising
actually
thing.
Pretty awesome.
I think if we ever list that house, we'll be like, neighbors like jazz. Cash offer only.
Yeah, well, you know, my neighbor runs a daycare, and she is louder than any kid.
You have to be.
So she's like, wah, wah, wah,
if the kids
wah,
are louder wah, than you, the daycare wah, fails, man.
Wah, wah. I won't put that in the real estate listing.
Anyway, them liking jazz is not super relevant, except that we heard their kids play jazz recently, even though they're now all at kind of prestigious music schools. Because they invited us to their end of summer party.
Oh. Was there more wife swapping at it than at yours?
You mean more than
100%?
If anybody leaves our party with their actual spouse, they're not invited next year.
Right.
Because that's, you know, that's kind of what Labor Day means to us, is just kind of free love and
laborious experimentation. Middle-aged sex.
Getting out. little LMAS, if you know what I mean.
Oh, boy. Woo, am I tired.
They usually, they go all out for Halloween, usually. And their partners are usually just like ours, in their house or in their backyard. You don't mind if I chew a beef stick while we do the show, do you?
Is that what it is? Mm-hmm. A beef stick? I mean, I've got some gum that I took out before the show. I could put it in again. The spearmint loses its flavor on the bedpost overnight.
A huge group of listeners have just turned off. But it doesn't matter. We already got there. It already counts if they listen to the show when we look at our numbers. So
how do ASMR people feel about gum chewing
versus beef chewing
while talking? Why do you have a beef stick over there?
For protein.
Oh my God, look at it. It's a legit stick of beef.
It was very long. I don't know if you ever, the Costco ones are like, somehow they're like a foot and a half long. You can use them for croquet mallets. You can use them to hitch your boat to the pier.
If any of our listeners doubted whether or not Ken shops primarily at Costco, let me dispel any doubt you might have had. I'm going to take this out, right?
Yeah, what are you doing?
I feel like that's just too much saliva.
They don't have Diet Dr. Pepper, so this is probably some kind of Kroger purchase, I'm going to guess.
You're holding up a can of Diet Dr. Pepper that we provide you here at Omnibus.
I brought this one, but there always does seem to be one in the fridge. It's the nicest, most magical little thing.
It's for you.
Like your mom bringing you a donut every morning.
Yeah.
A Diet Dr. Pepper appears in the fridge here every day.
I wish she brought me one every morning. She brings me one very irregularly.
Speaking of Diet Dr. Pepper, I was at the State Fair of Texas this week.
Yes, right.
And I'll tell you what, if you want to feel like Dr. Pepper and Diet Dr. Pepper are just omnipresent in the world, fly American Airlines into and out of the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
It's just a Dr. Pepper cluster?
Because, yeah. You know, in the world of Delta, you'd be mistaken for thinking that Coke is the only.
Oh,
so they're an Atlanta-based carrier. But American is based at DFW, and Dr. Pepper is the native Texas drink. Waco, I think.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I've told you before that my maternal grandfather, no, I'm sorry, my maternal great-grandfather used to get a Dr. Pepper and stand out on the street corner in Van Wert, Ohio, while his wife shopped in the town. He would stand out and nurse a Dr. Pepper all afternoon and talk to the other farmers.
Is she doing marketing or is she trying on hats? Like, is she...
Oh, no, she's trying on hats. I mean, you know, they would go downtown on a Sunday.
And he would...
Yeah, and she'd, you know, she'd buy a bolt of fabric.
I didn't know Van Wert was a dry county. He had to have a Dr. Pepper instead of something more interesting in his paper bag.
Well, I think that they are descended from good Quaker stock and, yeah, the teetotalers. And so he would, you know, my mom really associates Dr. Pepper with her grandfather.
With a very, very elderly... Yeah. Your mom in her 80s thinks of Dr. Pepper as an old-timey thing.
She does. She does. And he was, you know, he's one of those farmers that put a new roof on the barn when he was 85, you know, climbing up a three-story ladder.
Well, if you go to Texas, you cannot avoid.
It's a Texas drink.
I think, I mean, it's an ever, John, you can enjoy a good Dr. Pepper anywhere. That's but yeah, cool. But it still has the same kind of regional connections to Texas that Coke does to Atlanta.
Why do we not have a Dr. Pepper sponsorship? We talk about it so much on this show.
Yeah, we just basically read an ad.
Yeah.
I feel like I've gotten a little far afield from my neighbor having an end of summer party.
Oh, yeah. Let's go back to that.
So I asked her where...
Julie,
where's the party going to be? And she says, it's actually going to be at the Elks Lodge in Ballard. Now, I think Seattle's big enough that there are multiple Elks Lodges in town. And, you know, people like you and I who walk the Seattle sidewalks, we know where all the old... Oddfellows halls and Mason's
Swedish
lodges
American
are
halls. Yeah,
the
sure.
Woodmen of the world where their pancake breakfast is or was. I don't know if the last one died yet or not. You know, you get a sense if you live in a city for a long time of where these weird old buildings were from the age of that being a thing. But the one in Ballard is right on Shilshoal Bay.
Yeah.
So there's a little pocket beach that if you've ever spent any time in Ballard, you might know because it's kind of the only public shore access between Golden Gardens and the cut and the locks.
It's a great place to go make out if you're coming out of the Ballard bars in the middle of the night, but you don't want to go home to either of your houses because, you know, you're both married.
That's like your makeout beach?
Yeah, you go down to makeout beach there in Ballard.
You could drive up to Sunset Hill. That could be like Lover's Leap or whatever, Lover's Lane.
It's too conspicuous there. If you go to the beach in the middle of the night, nobody's there except for sailors who are sailing by. And so you get caught all the time.
Do they have lights out, hoping they'll see somebody with a hand under their shirt?
No, not searchlights, but, you know, there's always somebody... there's always somebody leaning on the railing of one of those tugs as they're going through the locks.
It's a different time
and
now,
like,
John.
Hey, wait a minute. There's two people making out
over there. You're going to see paddle boarders now.
Oh, yeah. But not in the middle. Oh, no, yeah, the night ones.
Yeah, because they got yoga at 5. They got to get some paddle boarding
in
first.
They're out to look at the sea. No, the little ones, the river otters. Not the sea otters, but the river otters. The ones that look like big rats.
We have both, but yes, I think you're thinking of the river otters.
River otters.
Anyway, so Ballard has changed a bit since your days making out there.
I'll say.
But right above the public beach there is still what has been there for decades and decades, which is Elks Lodge number whatever. And I said, that's amazing. So the Elks are, you know, because I have the sense that these fraternal organizations were in decline. I asked Julie, so the Elks are in enough decline that you can rent the space? She said they are. But when I priced it out, what I found out is that if I were to join the Elks...
You get $2 Rainiers.
every lodge night. And you can use that space. And I said, wait, so Oscar joined the Elks? And she said, no, Oscar only has spouse privileges. I joined the Elks.
Boom. Wait a minute. But she's a lady.
A lady Elk?
A Julie Elk.
It turns out that many of these organizations now... admit women. Let's just cover this now instead of jumping ahead. The Elks went co-ed in St. George, Utah, of all places, famously, you know, on the cutting edge of women's liberation.
In September of 2019.
In the early 90s, in 1993, a case went before the Utah Supreme Court claiming that these fraternal organizations are running up against the Civil Rights Act in their constitution, which said that, you know, you can't discriminate on the basis of gender. And the Utah Supreme Court did indeed find, you know, not a bastion of liberalism, even in 1993, agreed that, yeah, you know, freedom of expression or freedom of assembly means you could have a male-only club in St. George, sure. But if you want a liquor license, those are held to the standards of the Utah Civil Rights Act.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, you need to let in the ladies. And this began a wave of dominoes that went all over the country, often with the ACLU having to sue recalcitrant Elks Lodges.
Right.
Because there were women who wanted to join. And previously, like pretty much all of these organizations for the last American century or a little more, they had been male-only spaces. In fact, specifically Lodge Night was the place where you would get away from the wife and her nagging and prattling, and you could finally just get blotto with the boys.
Sit there and drink beer and smoke cigarettes.
So, such a rare chance for a 50s or 60s man to be with other men getting drunk and smoking. But they finally found a place where it was okay.
But famously, they would have events where you'd bring your wife and it was a,
yes,
you know, family.
So that's what my neighbor Oscar now has. He has spouse privileges. He can't bring guests, but Julie can sure bring him as a guest on the one night of the week where it's, or to the parts of the club that are... that are families allowed, non-Elks members allowed, you can bring guests. And this just blew me away, this idea that, I had, thinking of myself as, understanding how our new enlightened gender neutrality worked in America, I was amazed that even these old boy organizations had followed suit. And your wife could be an Elk and you would just shrug and go along.
So are you going to talk about the Ballard Eagles Hall?
Where is the Eagles Hall?
So the Eagles Hall
is on Ballard Ave?
No, it's half a block off of Ballard Ave. And in the 2000s...
Toward Leary or toward Market?
Toward Market.
Okay.
During the 2000s, mid-2000s, some hipster rock friend discovered that you could join the Eagles for... nothing, pennies on the dollar, and then you could go to the bar
and get cheap beer and spaghetti and meatballs.
Yeah, super cheap beer.
3 nights a week.
So the Eagles Hall went from a thing where the bar had six guys in their 60s sitting there steaming over over rye and coke to being full of the sort of alt country hipster 2006 hipsters of Ballard, because they all joined the Eagles Hall. It was the fashionable thing. And then they had that big hall which had all the seats, all the wood seats around it, like in a church, and then the big head eagle seat. And they had shows in there. I mean, it was briefly a thing where
they did rock shows in there.
Well,
They did country folk shows in there.
It was briefly like the Washington Athletic Club of a certain kind of alt country hip kid.
Do you think the lodge or the area or whatever it is was like, great, we're viable? Or were they like, oh boy, there goes the neighborhood?
No, I think they liked it because you couldn't be in Ballard at that time without, you'd throw a Frisbee golf disc in any direction and you'd hit somebody's white Stetson hat.
Hey, I'm trying to hacky sack here.
Hey, what are you doing? But this is crazy that you're doing this show, because I just got a text message 2 days ago from a friend who said, hey, we're putting a group together to take over the Burien Elks Hall and turn it into like a cool kid hangout.
Like they're going to become Elks, or they're just going to like buy it out and make it an all ages venue or something?
No, they're trying to do this Ballard thing. They're going to get 40 people together. Everybody's going to join the Elks.
Now we've given it away on the air, John.
Well,
the Grand Lodge, the National Grand Elks Lodge, is going to find out about this tactic.
So I wrote him back and I was like, I don't drink. And I have zero interest in hanging out with you guys at the Elks Hall, but thanks for writing.
Maybe you don't want to lead with, and I don't like to hang out with you ever.
I mean, that's kind of
a friendly email.
I was walking down the street the other day and my phone rang, and it was a guy I knew, and I picked it up and he said, I'm across the street from you and I wanted to see if you would answer the phone to my name. And you did.
Yay.
So you really got off the hook. And, you know, I most of the time I wouldn't have, but for whatever reason, I did, and I got off the hook.
So we had never been to this Ballard Elks Lodge right on the water there, but, because we'd been scared off by the parking. They have these places were here forever before, in all American cities, these places were here you know, long before property values doubled. So this is waterfront property where they have a huge empty parking lot with all the scary signs about how their towing company will not let you park here for the beach.
Right.
And we went to their end of summer party, and this building is...
It's a cool place, right?
Yeah, it's got... Have you ever been to an event there? It's got all these glass-fronted... you know, there was a wedding reception going on next door. They were not Elks. They had rented it out. But Julie, being an Elk, had gotten the other space on the water. There's little grassy terrace overlooking the beach, amazing view of the bay, of the Sound and the Olympics as the sun sets.
It feels
various sons were playing in their jazz combos and hardcore bands.
Oh, no kidding. Were they?
Yeah. And it just kind of, it had this old timey feel of, you know, here's the bar over here. It really did feel like you were Fred Flintstone and Barney Rubble at the Loyal Order of Water Buffaloes.
What's funny about the Elks Lodge is it's kind of a more modern building, whereas the...
Yes, these are not the old Masonic looking stone temples.
But that was the thing about the Eagles Hall was that it was truly like a brick pile. Like
a shrine.
And they had never cleaned it from the cigarette smoking days, so everything is yellow in there. Whereas the Elks Lodge is kind of, it feels like a Dale Chihuly joint.
Yeah, and in particular this one, you know, when Julie joined, I asked her, you know, she went through the whole induction where you have to swear something to God and maybe say the Pledge of Allegiance, still kind of an old-timey thing.
Yeah.
And I said, are you allowed to tell me this? Is the induction secret? She was like, I don't think they said that. They're like, these are like the young cool Masons.
Did she have to put an elk's head on and parade around in her all together?
I don't think they have the headdresses anymore. Although some of these, that's the trope of these plays. Because when I grew up watching, you know, the Gen X pop culture we got, mid to late 20th century, was all written by people whose dads all were members of these places. So, you know, that's what we saw would be, you know, Fred and Barney or Ed Norton and Ralph Cramden going to the Raccoon Lodge or Mr. C on Happy Days going to the Leopards downtown at the Milwaukee, whatever it was.
Yeah, they all wore fezes and...
Yeah, and they would all have weird headgear. Because the sitcoms would really play up on this element that, oh, you know, let's, you know, he's the grand, mystical, exalted poobah of the lodge and, you know, just the silliness of it. Was your dad ever in any of these?
Oh my God, no.
That kind of surprises me.
Well, he was not...
Was he above? He was above this. Was this a little middle class for him?
Yeah, there is a lot of class stuff in it, and the lodges did have a middle class thing that my dad was just sort of, he was in the Rotary Club.
Yeah,
and the Rotary Club is a different vibe that's much more like business.
That actually is a business and service organization, which a lot of these other. Came too late.
Yeah, right.
These ones did not form with any idea of community in mind.
Yeah, and so my dad was a very active Rotarian and was always sending some scholarship kid to Uzbekistan. And I went to many Rotary
meetings. That's a good use of the money.
Yeah, for sure.
Get those kids out of here.
Well, and,
make them go to Uzbekistan.
They come back with Uzbek culture, you know, and bring that to bear in the United States. Back?
That's a bummer.
But we have, within the Omnibus fan base, I'm here to tell you, a pretty active Masonic contingent. And I know that because they let me know that.
Yeah, I feel like we're going to get the Masons angry at us and we're going to start getting parking tickets.
Well, no, because...
The Masons control everything.
But the young Masons, and most of them are from East Coast lodges, right, in Pennsylvania and mostly in Pennsylvania, frankly. But they are, they're all very, like, you know, devoted to the kind of Masonic ideal, and they do the whole swords and sorcery.
All the regalia and the rituals.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that because the Elks don't have that so much.
They don't.
They were kind of created as, they were part of a generation of, hey, what if these lodges weren't all clouded in these weird past cobwebs and rigmarole?
Only reason that they exist.
I mean, that is true. But what if it was more about, like, I think they were the Elks were of the generation that were like, what if there was drinking, you know?
Ah, right.
Like, because the Masons and the Oddfellows, we get together and have a toast after dinner, but,
right.
You know, what if we really,
virgins.
What if we really foreground, yeah, exactly. What if we really foregrounded that element and didn't have a creepy altar?
Sure.
So I asked Julie, like, you know, because I was well aware of the decline of these institutions, and that was kind of what made me decide we should finally do this on Omnibus, because this is something that was absolutely central to American and European, but particularly American life for over 100 years, and now is in just remarkable sudden decline.
Let me ask you this, and I don't want to, if I'm tiptoeing around the daisies here, but isn't Mormonism just basically a Masonic offshoot? Isn't a lot of that stuff?
That's true. My parents and their friends never had any connection to any of these lodges.
But there was a lot of the same iconography.
So at the time that the early Mormon theology and religious practices were coming together in the Midwest,
this would have been.
It was kind of the dawn of America's fascination with these fraternal orders.
Right.
And
George Washington was a Mason.
And so to this day, the Mormon temple liturgy that Mormons go to their temples for is essentially has the form of a Masonic initiation. There's kind of a ritual drama that's portrayed. And the content is not, the content's very biblical stuff. The creation of the world, Adam and Eve fall and are gradually brought back to God, through Christ's grace.
Is there a pyramid with a big eye on the top of it at any point?
Some of the symbolism has been borrowed. Oh. Yeah. There are explanations of, here are the grips and the signs and the symbols, and they're clearly descendants of Joseph Smith's just fascination with what was going on down at the lodge that week, because these things had their roots in mystical Western esotericism, which had religious connections.
Right.
Let's just go through the history. In Joseph Smith's time, or a little later, let's say at the turn of the 19th century, a scholar named W.S. Harwood starts to do good scholarly work on the roles of these American fraternal organizations. And he finds out that if you add the biggest one's self-proclaimed membership, you get about 6.4 million American men are on the lodge in a country of 19 million men.
Whoa.
Now, some of these guys were...
I thought you were going to say if you combine them all, you get 33 million
you get more
American
men. Well, you actually could, because a lot of these people were going to multiple lodges. They would sign up for the Odd Fellows, and then later their neighbors would say, you got to come out to the Knights of the Maccabees, or the Ancient Order of the United Workmen, or the Modern Woodmen of America. There were literally dozens and dozens of these.
But that wouldn't be a conflict? And how many oaths can you take to a drinking organization?
I don't think any of them had NDAs. Well, they had NDAs, but I don't think any of them had non-competes.
Oh, okay.
You would definitely say, hey, don't tell the Fraternal Order of the Eagles all the secrets of the Patriotic Order of the Sons of America and vice versa.
Yeah,
I think it was understood that, our lodge night is Wednesday, and a lot of the boys go down to the Eagles on Thursday, and that's just how you roll. And that wasn't true at first. I think as we go back further, we'll see that these organizations did function differently. But, today it's estimated that between 20 and 40% of American men between the Civil War and, say, the Depression did belong to one of these clubs, orders, tabernacles, temples, nests, lodges, hives, tents, Aries, covens, dens. They had all these kind of funny club names.
Yeah, right.
Just because your leader is the winged, you're in the Eagles, you're in an Eerie number 1806, your leader is the winged nest egg, or grand high exalted falcon or whatever. It's a little silly. But fun. And I think it kind of predates fun. The fun came later. American lodges of the Masons and the Odd Fellows actually predate the Revolution. They're older than the country.
Yeah.
Like, as you mentioned, George Washington, the founding fathers, many of them did attend, had connections to Freemasonry.
And the secret aspect of it was what? Was why?
I can't tell you, John.
Oh, right. Sorry.
I don't want the Masons coming after me.
Oops.
No. So the problem with studying the early history of the older organizations of this kind, the Odd Fellows, and particularly the Masons, is that it's a purely oral tradition before around 1700. All you have is what the organization claims that their lineage is. And they make incredibly grandiose claims. The tradition of the Masons, of course, is that they have the secret hidden knowledge of Hiram Abiff, the Mason who constructed the foundation of Solomon's temple.
Right.
Whereas the Odd Fellows like to say they go back to the Roman Enlightenment of Nero and Titus and the emperors of that era, and there's no good historical evidence for any of this.
That we have access to.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe the Masons are keeping it from us.
Yeah.
It seems pretty clear that the connections you can draw are to the guilds. You know, these started out as, there's a reason why these places are called
woodmen, carpenters,
masons. You know, they were originally the guild that represented the mercantile interests of the stonemasons. And then at some point, what filtered in was this kind of, as I say, the Western esotericism, that kind of a third way that grew up at a time when, I don't know, maybe the church is weakening enough that you think, well, maybe there are alternatives. You know, I don't have to limit myself to what Father whatever says about the Bible. You know, what about these Enlightenment guys writing in France and Germany? Or what about these mystical traditions that I'm starting to hear about? You know, so Rosicrucianism filters into these trade organizations.
They weren't pagan alternatives to the church. They were...
The church saw them that way. Yeah. The Catholic Church was extremely anti-Masonic for many years. And in the end, in America, just decided, well, if you can't beat them, join them. And they founded the Knights of Columbus. You know, right. Like, okay, we know you guys want to go have your beer and say your mottos. Let's just do it down at the parish, and we'll also do a food drive at Christmas, you know? So the church did consider this to be anti-Christian, but the funny thing is, a lot of the, you know, Masonry became became a political flashpoint in America in the early 19th century, to the degree that, the most successful third party of the 1830s was an anti-Masonic party, you know, whose sole platform was, this is creepy and we don't get it, let's keep them out of society and government. But the funny thing is, that went hand in hand with all the anti-Catholic prejudices of the time, you know, so they were kind of viewed both as, you know, bad, heretical, quasi-religion.
Well, and that's true of the current conspiracy universe, which is anti-Mason and also anti-Semitic.
Right. A lot of the anti-Mason rhetoric, you know, they control institutions. Yeah. They have too much money and too much power. It's exactly boilerplate anti-Semitism too.
If you look at any of the correspondence I've had with the young Masons, young hipster Masons of Pennsylvania, they have so far given me no indication that they are in control of the world.
Do they seem to not even have the capability for it?
Well, they wouldn't let me know if they did.
I think you could kind of tell, like, this guy puts two spaces after a period. Like, this guy just left the apostrophe out of its. He's not taking over.
Yeah, there are some questionable banks. Choices in terms of, like, which glasses frames they wear that make me feel like, no, not in charge, at least.
And as you point out, these early societies were really heavy on ritual. You would have to be initiated via a series of secret rites. A lot of the rites centering on the threats, you know, the fates that would befall you if you were to betray in any way the Masons or the Oddfellows or whoever the group was. You know, they would blindfold you and press ice into you and say they were branding you. Ooh. They would put you up on a board and pretend they were carrying you around the room and then pretend to drop you, and so you would step off. There are cases of people having heart attacks because they thought they were getting branded during their fraternal initiation. A guy fell on his ceremonial sword once and almost died because there were swords and hats and uniforms. And
I have a lot of them.
And aprons. Yeah. And you inherited them all when people died.
I have a whole umbrella stand full of Masonic swords.
And... So the funny thing is, being a Mason, you know, today we were like, well, why do these organizations exist? Clearly they're about community, or they're about conviviality or fellowship or something. At the time, you joined Masonry because it was about Masonry. You'd go to your Masonic temple, and the lodge would have a little talk about one of the Masonic principles. You know, it was maybe not unlike church, you know, where you go to Christianity and it's all about Christianity.
So, but you're not talking about like go and
learn
have
how
a,
to
have a talk about a good trowel, right? Like,
no, like you would go to Masonry and they would talk about the importance and lore of Masonry.
I see.
Because one of the goals is you would advance, you know, you would get to different levels of craft. You know, they were, and today that
you'd
seems
go clear.
Today that seems pernicious because we associate it with Scientology. But if you think about organizations that try to rope in viewers by giving them like higher levels of prestige, and you know, that's how the Girl Scouts also works. You know, like
right.
Lots of organizations are like, hey, the longer you're here, the more the more merits and little doodads you'll win.
Well, that's why there's a number 33 on every bottle of Rolling Rock.
Is that true?
Yeah.
It's the 33rd order of Masonry or
well,
something?
Well, or it's the 33rd order of Rolling Rock beer.
I mean, it's why we have 5 Patreon tiers.
Yeah, that's right.
We want you to reach the highest level of craft and truly understand the grand architect of the universe. And the only way to do that is to give Omnibus $100 a month. So it's kind of interesting, you know, it's not what you imagine as the American mid-century Fred and Barney go to the Water Buffalo's Lodge, because it really is all about reciting chants and enacting these ritual dramas, initiating new converts, and then maybe there would be a dinner and a toast. But that wasn't what Masonry was about. Masonry was about Masonry and kind of these, in the tradition of Rosicrucianism and these Western esotericism, it would be about capital T truth and capital T thought. And you know, there would be all these
Enlightenment pillars.
Vast principles. Yeah. That one was to contemplate and master.
Boy, remember the days when there were principles.
Are you nostalgic for Freemasonry? Because at least
no,
I remember when it was about the Masonry.
I remember when a Mason knew some stuff about the Temple of Solomon.
And there was some sense that these were elites, you know, they definitely had that sense in themselves. We have the hidden knowledge and this, you know, our temple is the only place you can get it if you're a good brother. But also they tended to become nexuses for societal power. Right. You know, this really was the place where, you know, not to spread anti-Masonic, you know, protocols of the elders of Hiram Abiff, but this was the place where a lot of well-to-do people met and had their social club, and you know, it kind of functioned as an elite gentleman's club, and that did lead to suspicion from the church and from the press.
Harry Truman, but you know, but I've always felt like this was just so like town dependent. Like Van Wert, Ohio, right, would be the prominent one would be the Elks Club, and the Masons would be not cool.
And
you know,
10 miles down the road, all the cool shop owners would be in the Odd Fellows.
Yeah, exactly.
Or the like Foresters.
J. Edgar Hoover was a Mason, and so all the FBI agents would be Masons, but
they always say that, but you have to wonder, like, were these guys super into it, or is it the kind of, like, just, you know, coming from a Mormon background, I know how eager, you know, possible it is to say, well, such and such was a Mormon, right. And it just means they were raised Mormon. They weren't going to meetings every Sunday, and I kind of wonder how many of these, you know, maybe George Washington, you know, in college had a bunch of Freemason friends.
But there's so many pictures of Washington where he's got an apron on and he's holding a trowel and he's, you know, like,
that's what the Masons want you to think.
Oh, of course.
It serves their ends to have him holding the compass of the grand architect of the universe.
But what about the pyramid on the dollar bill? Like, am I being a conspiracist by thinking that that's surely a Masonic symbol, isn't
it? Well, I think it definitely, you know, if it doesn't come from Masonry, they do both come from the fact that they were both offshoots of just this Rosicrucian sense that this is what intellectuals were interested in, these lofty mystical principles of truth and light and craft and so forth.
So the other day I was on Instagram, as you do, and I was fed in between my videos of cats falling off of window ledges and so forth, fed this video of a bunch of late middle-aged black men dancing in a circle where they were obviously like prominent, well-to-do men who had this kind of ritual circle dance.
And do you think it was just theirs, or were they part of an organization that did the circle dance in their hall?
Well, so I looked into it, and they were members of the Prince Hall Lodge of Masonry, which was an all-black Masonic offshoot that formed a kind of that I think, as far as the reading I did, you know, blacks weren't allowed into,
right,
Masonry.
Segregated lodges.
But Masonry was secular enough and interested in the pillars that they did allow for there being a separate African-American path.
Possibly in the same way that they had a ladies' auxiliary, like, right, a lot of these places did.
But then as time's gone on, that became such a flourishing corner of Masonry,
huh,
that now finally there's a they're integrated back into the larger family of Masonry.
Yeah, as we'll see, you know, as this basically took over America in the 19th century, it meant that everybody had to have a lodge. You would want one if you didn't have one, which meant that if you couldn't get into the elite Mason ones, some middle-class ones started. Immigrant targeted lodge, working-class lodges, African-American lodges, all these, you know.
Ku Klux Klan.
Well, that's what happens. I mean, that's, you're not wrong. A lot of this happened around the time of the Civil War, where a bunch of people started to think, these Masons are kind of hoity-toity and weird. And I think there would be a way to do all this, but actually for it to be fun. And if you want to think about what kind of adult would lead out on this kind of thing, I bet you would not be surprised to hear that it was actors.
Oh.
A real plague on society. It was America's actors.
John Wilkes Booth.
Yes, like of that type, you know. It was a time when, you know, that was one of the few outlets for bohemianism in American life, was to be part of the theatrical circuit.
Right.
You would travel a lot. You weren't really beholden to norms of good civic behavior.
You could dress a little foppishly.
It would be okay. Yeah, like it was, you know, now we think of it as like, you know, a safe, you know, proto-queer-coded space, because you could dress up in elaborate outfits. And that's absolutely what happened in a lot of these places. An actor, for example, named Justice Henry Rathbone, like a family of maybe upstate New York preachers, had quit law school around 1850 because his true love was the stage.
Yes.
Maybe today we would assume that these were all closeted gay kids, and the same was true of probably me. Were.
I quit law school because you wanted my first to play love Hamlet. Was the stage. That's right. The Dane, we call him.
The Scottish play. And so he ends up in a troupe kind of crisscrossing the Midwest, and history changes in 1861 because his troupe runs out of money in the middle of nowhere, Upper Peninsula, Michigan, where they had their last booking. And suddenly, you know, there's, he was going to do Orestes and Ypsilanti, and now he's got nothing to do.
Can you imagine upstate Michigan in 1861?
Being the actors passing through.
Wow.
It's a Deadwood episode. Anyway, he finds himself in Copper Harbor, Michigan, kind of a boring lumber camp, spending the winter.
Can confirm.
With a chest full of costumes and nothing to do. And one of his favorite plays had always been, if we're continuing our suspicion that poor Justice Henry Rathbone would be a happy gay man today, he loved the story of Damon and Pythias, about two Greek, it's a quasi-mythological story, I don't know if it's from Ovid or Hesiod or what, two Greek friends who are so close that one ends up sacrificing his life for the other.
Oh.
And
saucy.
But, you know, male fellowship,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just like ours, yours and mine.
Yeah, nothing necessarily gay about Damon and Pythias.
No.
Just because they're kissing and cuddling in jail together.
Yeah, wearing fancy costumes in the Upper Peninsula.
Wearing elaborate robes in the forest. He decides to found a new organization that would be like the Masons, because, you know, he's got all the costumes and the hats and the swords and stuff. He can put on a bit of a show, but it would just be all for fun. It would be an actor's take. Not a true believer's take on the regalia and the rigmarole of Masonry.
That does seem fun.
He founds the Knights of Pythias, which you know, suddenly finds a huge new booming middle-class membership in kind of Civil War era America. Not too long after, in 1868, the minstrel show community, not yet on Broadway. I think at the time, Broadway would have been pretty far uptown. You know, wherever that's centered, kind of in... you know, more towards the southern end of Manhattan.
Right. Four Corners.
Right, probably. They have a sick performer in their midst. You know, it's a closely knit social circle. They have a sick performer in their midst, and they decide to form a mutual aid society for him. And they decide one of the ways to raise money would be, you know, a weekly party where you would pay your dues and come have a good time with your fellow minstrel show doofuses. Hopefully no blackface allowed.
Weekly party.
They called it the Jolly Corks. And quickly changed their name to the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks.
That's, oh, no kidding.
Yeah, the first Elks were, you know, semi-employed
and were,
actors.
And were based in New York, a place famously elk-free for the most part, New York City.
Yeah, it's like they're reaching for a mythology they don't have, in the same way that the Cub Scouts have all their Kipling-era bobcats and wolves and bears. You want something that seems kind of ancient and noble, so you pick an eagle or an elk or a... or a moose in one case.
But connected to the frontier, the American wilderness. That's interesting.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, they picked a very American animal. That's a great point. Yeah, they're not the tigers, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, there is some of that. I think there is a sense that we are making the kind of the American secularized version of these kind of creepy, cobwebby, old-timey ones. Like, the elks don't say a certain set of weird incantations about Jubal Earl and his brother Tubal Cain. They say the Pledge of Allegiance.
You
know, like, this is more like a civic public square kind of a thing.
Heck right.
In 1870, two or three men, one of whom, again, is an actor named William Florence, and he's a dedicated Mason, goes to, as part of his acting career, he happens to be in Marseille, and he finagles his way into a party being given by an Arab diplomat to France.
This is
And he is just...
talking about a sex show.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of thing he would love, I'm sure. You know, all the flowing silk robes and the winking women in veils, maybe boys too, who knows? There's fezes and there's snake charmers and, you know, who knows what there is. But he thinks, you know, masonry needs this. Our dusty old aprons are not 19th century. What if there was a cool party Arabian-themed Masons? And he founds
the Shriners.
Yeah. He's like, what if masonry had a fez instead of a like a weird little beret thing?
So my mom hates Shriners.
Why? Because of the little cars keep running her over?
Hates them. No, because she used to work as a waitress in Columbus, Ohio in the early 1950s. And she said the Shriners would come in, and it was a nice restaurant. The Shriners would come in, and they were real ass grabbers. Like really handsy with the wait staff. And she said there was a tradition within the Shriners that they would actually carry a cattle prod and that they would cattle prod
the server?
The servers. And so what it did is it instilled in her, in the same way that my mom cannot stand Appalachians because of her Northern Ohio prejudices.
And she hates Elvis.
Against white trash. She despises the Shriners. Even now, 89 years old, if you confronted her with a Shriner fez, she would say some Quaker incantation at it.
Look, you're putting a lot of middle-aged, small-town American men in a room and telling them this is the fun place where all constraints are off.
Right.
And your wife can't tell you to put out your cigar. Like, I'm not surprised that this is some of the behavior you get. Now we're going to get letters from well-behaved Shriners, and they're going to run us over in their little cars.
There was a Shriner temple close to my house that was called the Al-Aqsa temple, and you know, done in like Middle Eastern
in the
script.
In the Arabic.
Yeah, but Alaska, basically. And they had the little cars. They did the whole nine.
Well, there's that golf course right off the freeway in Snohomish County. Right. Yeah, the Nile Shrine golf course or whatever. I guess the Nile is Arabian enough for their purposes. The idea was, masonry has gone, you know, it's too boring for the new generation with their kind of old dad lectures about truth and light and the order of the universe.
Boring.
What we want is just to like have a keg.
Yeah. Right.
And that's kind of how a lot of these American ones start, and it becomes huge. It's, you know, we are not yet to the point where community service seems to be an important part of these organizations. I saw records, the Odd Fellows are claiming that they were always giving to orphans back to the 18th century, but it really seems like this is how, the way they operated was kind of how we understand it from sitcoms. It's a place once a week where you go to lodge night and get away from your wife and get away from women because, you know.
Now, was this a thing where you could go, were people also getting away from church? Was this like a... You got to go to church on Sunday, but you can go to this and be...
I mean, this is happening from the 1870s to the 1930s. So I think this is a time when good upstanding people, whether they're immigrants or shopkeepers or middle class, they're probably all still going to church on Sunday.
Yeah.
Like,
but this is like where you could be yourself instead of the fake piety of your... of getting dragged to church on Sunday.
Maybe. And maybe that was the advantage they had against the ones that did have kind of the theological bent, you know, the Odd Fellows and the Freemasons.
How is this connected to fraternities in college? Did you have any fraternity experience when you were in college?
I mean, UW has a pretty big Greek system, but it always just seemed kind of old-timey and embarrassing. But, you know, kids are still rushing all those frats.
My dad was a member of Phi Gamma Delta, and he, even when he was in his 80s, and I went to him and said, why don't you tell me your Phi Gamma Delta secret stuff? He got really offended. Like hell. I'll never tell.
I think it was like, the branding there is the Greek system is Freemasonry for the campus.
Right.
You know, obviously all warm-blooded men are going to want a place like this with elaborate rules and shenanigans and ceremonies, because we all have that ritualistic thing. And I think you're right. Maybe the decline of high church stuff in America leads people to want a place where they can have their incantations and their secret hand signals.
I lived at a fraternity in Cornell for a summer.
Why?
Because I had a friend that was a brother in the fraternity. I won't name it. And I went there because I was...
You needed a couch.
Yeah, I was like surfing couches for all my youth, basically. And I remember some grown men came, you know, fraternity brothers came one day to visit. And I happened to be sitting in the public space, you know, with my socks up on the coffee table. And they came in, and so I stood up and went to shake their hands, and they did something funny.
They thought you were a pledge,
yeah.
And they thought you would know the secret handshake.
So they gave me some weird thing with the hands, and I was like, huh?
They could have just been coming on to you. You don't know.
Well, but they looked shocked.
Because you didn't do it back.
When I didn't do the thing. Mm. And they immediately recognized that I was not a brother. They were shocked that I was there. And they got very cold because I was like, what was I supposed to do there? And so I have this visceral memory of being shown the secret handshake, but I wasn't.
Couldn't do it in time.
Yeah, I wasn't fast enough. And so I'll never know it, you know?
I guess it occurs to me now that the boundary creation is a big part of the success of these things. Like, it's not enough just to have a place where you can go and have fun or have your own little rules. Like, you really need the sense that others don't have it.
Yeah, yeah.
That you've created a space where you know secret knowledge that others don't, even if it's stupid secret knowledge about, you know, how you tie your apron or whatever.
Yeah, right. This handshake, I mean, just by their reaction, you could tell this was serious business to them. And I was like, I don't even go to Cornell. I'm just here because there's a kitchen.
But that is the kind of story that makes you sympathetic to some of the anti-Masonic, like, you know, connections are happening that are going to drive the world of politics or business in some way, and I literally don't know the secret handshake.
Yeah.
The fastest decline, interestingly, in these organizations seems to have happened as late as the 1980s, and maybe that's because that's when the people started to die. You know, like,
maybe it was me. Maybe Cornell started the whole thing.
I mean, obviously, maybe new membership had been on the decline for a while, but the big bump was just the first old guys start to die the greatest generation starts to die in the 80s. But the writing was on the wall long before. The Great Depression really put the kibosh on what is now called the golden age of fraternalism in America. And, you know, sociologically, we can speculate for a lot of the reasons. Some of it is bad press because the last big boom, the last big successful secret society in around 1915, as you allude to, with secret headgear and vows and meetings and stuff, was the Klan, the reorganized Klan. And that really was a black eye in the name of a lot of these secret societies, even the ones that weren't burning stuff down.
It made the
middle class, there was a sense that this was bad behavior to join one of these, who knows what's going on behind those closed doors. And, you know, maybe it didn't immediately make people leave the Elks, because everybody knew that was just beer night. But, you know, over time, it was like, you're in a secret society with a grand what now?
Yeah.
Really? Well,
and that's that class association that I still have because of my older parents, that feeling of like, oh, so you're one of those? Like, you're a...
And the funny thing is, it was just a working man's thing because it was a reaction against
the
older societies being a little too fancy pants.
Yeah, I see.
And it's easy to guess why sociologically this stuff might have declined in the, you know, from the from World War II on.
But you do think of it as like a big part of Mr. Cunningham's 1950s world,
right? And even, you know, even there's an Archie Bunker episode where he's a member of the Kings of Queens or something. You know, it was an idea that it was kind of an old fashioned, you know, working man or small town thing to do.
Yeah, you could see it being a Fresh Prince of Bel Air episode.
Yeah, right,
the last
some big African American lodge.
Yeah,
the on Lopez Island, you know, my brother and sister-in-law were staying with us, and they went to the pancake breakfast at the whatever the Woodmen Hall is there. You know, the organization still exists, but yeah, a lot of them are, you know, valuable real estate and are looking, trying to figure out what comes next. You know, when my friend joined the Ballard Lodge, they were, you know, they're proud to have a, you know, a high achieving working woman there. And they said, you know, we're the youngest Elks Lodge in the world.
Average age 57.
55.
Oh, was it really?
You are exactly right. Average age 55.
Let me in. Well, how much of the VFW took over some of that?
Oh, that's interesting.
Because the VFW is a lodge, but a special membership, right? You have to be a veteran of a foreign war.
And that would have been the exact same time frame. People come home and are looking for what they do on a Thursday night. And, you know, if half of them were in World War II,
right,
that seems like a place to hang out.
Yeah, you go there, smoke cigarettes, and don't talk about what happened in the war.
In the same way that Masonry always talks about Masonry, veterans of foreign wars do not talk about foreign wars. You know, Robert Putnam's the name of the guy that wrote that article, Bowling Alone, in the 90s, and then later followed it up with a book just about kind of the death of American, or the decline of American civic engagement. He was just fascinated by the fact that more Americans were bowling than ever. Like, bowling numbers were way up, and yet bowling league enrollment was way down. People were just not joiners anymore. And he rejects the idea that it's, he examines the idea that it could be mobility, people moving around more. And kind of, you know, so you don't have the hall you've been going to since you were in your 30s. He kind of rejects that. He, you know, it's easy to blame the women's movement, or, you know, to point to the women's movement. Except that the women's organizations actually declined before, you know, 10 years before.
Like Soroptimist, or what were some of the women's?
No, I mean, just like, you know, well, I mean, all these fraternal orders had their women's auxiliaries.
Sure.
And then there would be sewing circles and luncheon groups and church groups. And, you know, those all sagged 10 years before the male ones started to.
I don't think sagged is the word you want to use.
I think it's probably pretty accurate. The Masons, interestingly, have just decided you can be a woman Mason, but the only way to do it is to transition. Like if a good Masonic brother decides to come out as a woman, she's still a Mason.
What? Are Masons not, have they not allowed
Masons are not co-ed, no.
But you can transition.
Yes.
And remain a Mason.
Yes. And in fact, if you're a man, I mean,
how can they be that progressive and not let women in?
That's what I think is so funny, that like they have their finger on the pulse of, at least this is an article out of the UK, so it's even by whatever weird standards trans acceptance is in Britain.
Right.
But they've, and it works the other way, by the way. If you're a woman who transitions, if you were assigned female at birth and you come out as a man,
you can
become a Mason.
Interesting.
Without any kind of, I mean, I'm sure there's weird genitalia checks going on at every Masonic lodge, but nothing special for their trans members.
Right.
But they're still like, oh no, cis women, absolutely, that's a bridge too far. They need to be in the ladies' Masonic luncheon league.
Right.
But Putnam lands on the idea that it's probably two things. You know, demographics just change. Fewer, you know, it's married, stable married men with kids who tend to, you know, have the stability and the civic sense of ownership that they join these things. And if fewer men get married, if more men get divorced, families are smaller, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there's less sense that you're part of a local economy and therefore you're not joining whatever the guys at the Chamber of Commerce or that you had lunch with, whichever their lodge is, you know, it just doesn't happen anymore. But I think the big one's got to be TV. Don't you think it's TV?
Well, you know, I was going to say that the American cult of individualism, you know, there's something about a Masonic lodge where you're really throwing in with your neighbors as, you know, you're all members, again, of the same class, and this is a leveler, and we're all elks.
And yeah, and maybe you show up at the Elks Lodge, and the mayor is there, and also maybe the guy that changed your oil is there.
Yeah, this is the thing that unites us, and now, post-Vietnam, we put so much, you know, so much status on how each of us is a radical individual. The idea of going to a place where we're all the same
and reciting a catechism, basically. But yeah, maybe it's declining for the same reason religion is.
Right. I mean, I think that in Seattle, the going to see the Mariners is the only thing that
that's our civic religion.
That you look around and you go, well, I guess I'm one of these people because I'm at a baseball game.
And it's basically Protestantism. You know, the Mariners do get led to the slaughter, you know, like
every year.
It is kind of a...
They die for our sins?
Yeah, they basically die for our sins every year. But I really think there is something to the idea that leisure changed as soon as you had a TV in your living room and it was pretty much better than anything you could do in town. You know, like, yeah, you could go to the malt shop or you could go to your... Eagles or Knights of Pythias meeting.
Yeah, you can watch Archie Bunker go to his fraternal.
Exactly, you could or like amazing, you know, amazing laughs and drama or cop drama are coming to your couch.
Do you think there's any? I'm sure you've thought of this. Is there any version of the future where we're not just all consumed by a media monolith where we just don't do anything anymore?
It just feels inevitable. If you know, if you do believe that technology changing leisure is the big thing that led to the bowling alone phenomenon, then it's getting more and more isolating. You know, now we're all on an individual screen seeing what we want to see, not what CBS wants, you know, me and all my friends to see.
Like tonight, you and I and our families are all going to a big rock concert downtown, and before that we're going to dinner, so we'd better get done with this episode soon because we're going out. but it feels definitely different than it did even 10 years ago.
It feels like a big special event, like, yeah. And it wasn't just COVID. It was like, yeah, I guess once once every few months I put together a big dinner out, a night out.
Yeah, I mean, you and Mindy go to see Blonde Redhead every time they come to town, but other than that, you know, when was the last time we all went to dinner out and then a show?
And the idea that, you know, and part of it, obviously, it's very hard to disentangle these conversations from the individual aging, you know?
Right.
Yeah, I used to go to shows every week because I was 28, not 48. I mean, but it does seem like I watch my kids and even they have to get talked into doing things with their friends. A lot of those, you know, they didn't have civic organizations, but they had communal spaces like malls.
Yeah.
And now they're not doing that because, no, I'm talking to, what are you talking about? I'm talking to my friends right now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, bowling alone is just going to get more and more alone. The question is, what do you replace masonry with? You know, what's 21st century masonry? What's the thing that people want to do together? Polyamory?
Let's hope. And that concludes Lodge Night. Entry 731.GN2922, certificate number 35320 in the omnibus. Futurelings, social media died an inglorious death at some point between now and when you are listening to this show, maybe within hours.
I guess that's the weirdest bowling alone thing, is that nobody even wants to be on a big social media platform
together.
Think about
that. Social media was a leveler, right? Social media brought us together in a weird way where although you could talk to somebody famous, you were still both on Twitter.
Yeah.
And now even that is gone. I mean, that's one of the problems, right, with social media, was that we all realized very gradually that we actually didn't want to hear what our neighbors thought, and then increasingly didn't want to hear what our friends thought.
You kind of wanted to use it as TV. You know, you were interested in what news organizations and celebrities and writers were saying.
Yeah, and then pretty soon it was just like people who were talking about their prejudices and talking about their just like unwelcome opinions about things, and you want to kind of go back to a time when there actually were authorities that you could trust, and you didn't just have to fave just a tweet from somebody about like animal abuse or something. You know, you're just like, why the hell am I listening to you?
You could just you could trust all the knowledge about the universe you got from Masonic rituals.
Yeah, exactly.
Those were the days.
But the idea that egalitarianism or social leveling was a benefit was really dispelled when you finally met all the other people and went, oh, I don't want to be one of you.
Yeah, it worked, you know, I don't know, 1930 to 1970.
Yeah.
The American experiment worked.
Yeah, when you actually just had neighbors and you all were trying to grow soybeans, or you all worked at the Boeing factory.
Needed somebody to pick up your kid at school.
Right. I mean, yeah, there was a lot more. You just had more in common with the people in your town. Whereas here, even on my own street, I have, well, it's not like I have very much in common with any other living soul.
What about the daycare kids? You probably have something in common with them.
I do not. If they were all fed into a Soylent Green machine, I would be better.
You're always yelling about Adventure Time episodes.
That's true. Adventure Time, come on, get your pants. You can still find us, presumably, under @OmnibusProject at various social media. Is there an @OmnibusBlueSky or Threads account?
No, you know what?
So we're not on all social media.
I guess I should start up. Did I buy Omnibus on Blue Sky? I'm going to have to buy something, I guess. I mean, not buy, but...
Get.
I got a code.
Grab. We'll do grab. It. Do it now before some listener grabs it.
Problem with Blue Sky is it's not in browser. Oh. Like, I spend a lot of my day on a computer. I don't want to pull out my phone to see what's happening on Blue Sky.
Oh, it's only on phone.
Yeah, it's not in... It's app only right now.
Weak.
Beta.
You can find us at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick various places. I posted something about Prince's guitar pedals.
I saw that
the other day.
He's got some surprisingly downmarket guitar pedals.
But then like 70 comments down the thread, somebody who ran a calligraphy studio, somebody whose job was I'll decorate your wedding invitations or something, commented Bean Dad. It's like, well, that's both a salient comment and also it's a very clever one, but you could have calligraphied it at least. So social media still sucks in every way. Stay off of there. But you can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can hang out with other futurelings on social media and hopefully most of them are smart and fun. So just Google futurelings and pick the spot you like the best.
Liking Omnibus is a thing that will self-select for good community bonding in the future.
You can. That's right. If you're a futureling, I mean, that's...
That's kind of true, actually. Fandom has replaced fraternalism in a way, right?
Right.
Like, of course I'm going to hang out with these guys. They like blonde redhead, just like me.
But do you think that there are local Star Trek fan groups? I mean, there certainly are local Dungeons & Dragons groups.
Yeah, there's meetups for that kind of thing.
But is... Is Star Trek fandom just a centralized...
At least it used to be, you know, yearly you could go down to the Best Western by the highway and...
hang
out with the comic or the Star Trek guys and maybe Chekhov would be there.
But now even
that's just a big city circus.
You can mail us things like uranium cubes or swords. We actually have received a sword in the mail from a futureling.
It was not a Masonic sword, right? It was a problematic sword.
Yeah, it was. I mean, depending on how you connect the fraternal organizations, yeah, it was problematic. But right in the old umbrella stand with the other ones. But you can send us things P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155. And crucially, if you don't have a sword to send us, you can subscribe to the show and support it at patreon.com/omnibusproject. All kinds of great benefits, including, I think, one of the best benefits, which is a free episode every month, available only to Patreon subscribers, where we review viewer mail and comment upon it.
We will instruct you in higher and higher levels of craft as you advance in our Patreon towards some of the grand exalted secrets of Omnibus.
37th level magic user at omnibusroleplaying.com. Don't go to that. I don't know what that is. Omnibusroleplaying.com.
I don't know what the noun would be. I guess it's just the order. It's the exalted order of futurelings or the industrial worldwide benevolent order of futurelings. Somebody needs to start designing robes and fezes and little cars and swords and stuff.
Omnibusroleplaying.com is still available, and it doesn't look like it's even like anybody parking there. So
we have that one listener doing some kind of fantasy role-playing campaign in an omnibus dystopia.
Where you and I were both bugbears hiding in caves waiting to eat them.
I'm a gelatinous cube. Yes. And you're an ochre jelly.
And then, that's all I had to say. Ken, take it away.
See, terrestrial radio still lives. And that's about it. Over to you,
okay,
Stan.
That's the drive time news.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we so fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may well be our final word. But if the grand architect of the universe allows, we hope to be back to you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.